Mike, yes, I'm here. Thanks, Mike. And good evening, everybody, and welcome to another session of Broken Bread. This is a joint production by newliferadio.co.uk with Mike Coles in Exeter and me from BibleBase.com. And we've combined to bring you a series of conversational, one-way conversational studies in the letter to the Galatians, which I'm calling To the Churches of the Galatians. So this is officially study 22, and the title of it is Two Sons and Two Covenants. In a sense, this really ought to be study 22a, because what I want to do is study some of the verses in Galatians chapter 4, but one of the key verses I'm going to miss out, because I want to spend some time with that, God willing, next time we are together. Now, normally, of course, in these broken bread studies, I usually start off with an introduction. So tonight, by way of a change, I'll start off with the conclusion. And they say that good preaching always has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's what I try to do, but they don't always come in that order. Okay, I want to make some statements. These are the conclusions. There's a series of conclusions here, and then I'm going to work my way backwards. Here we go. These two covenants, remember the title is Two Sons and Two Covenants. These two covenants are mutually exclusive and are incompatible with each other. These two covenants are either or covenants. The way of law works and the way of faith are mutually exclusive. There can be no compromise. There can be no mixture of covenants. The introduction of the new covenant created an authentic paradigm shift. Most times when you hear that phrase, paradigm shift, it's really just a minor or a major modification of the status quo and the way we see things. But the inauguration of the new covenant creates an authentic paradigm shift. If any man, Paul says, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, if any man be in Christ, he becomes a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. That is an authentic paradigm shift. This axiom that these two covenants are mutually exclusive and that it's effected a paradigm shift, this axiom is really the reason that I created BibleBase.com with its sub-title line, An Explorer's Guide to the New Covenant. Let me illustrate by way of an allegory. Most of the listeners to this study will be aware that in the world of computers, there are two major operating systems. And yes, I know about Linus. But for most of us, there are just two operating systems, Microsoft Windows and Mac OS, Macintosh OS. Now, here's the rub. A program or an application designed to run on a Windows computer will not run on a Macintosh computer. And conversely, a program designed to run on a Macintosh computer will not run on a Windows computer. They are incompatible. As many of us know, the two systems will not play together nicely, as they say. You must choose, and the choice, to some extent, will determine your computing destiny. There are two operating systems for a living relationship with God. We call those covenants. That's an operating system for a living relationship with God. We call them covenants. There are other covenants recorded in the Bible, but these are the two operating systems for those who desire to live their lives as the people of God, or as the Bible often refers to them, the saints. Now, I've used my Bible program on my particular operating system to search the Old and New Covenant records and can only find one instance of an individual being called a saint. You see, saints is a collective term. This isn't just about personal salvation. This is becoming part of the people of God, the saints. Okay, let's read these verses. I'm going to read them now. Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 to 31. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise, which things are an allegory. The one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, Rejoice, O barren, you who did not bear, break forth and shout, you who were not in labor. For the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what does the Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son. For the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not become entangled again with the yoke of bondage. You'll notice that passage really runs on into chapter 5. Chapter 5 begins, or at least one of the earliest words is therefore, and you can't have therefore at the beginning of a chapter because it means you've got to look backwards over your shoulder to see how you got there. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at, first of all, about this fact that Abraham had two sons. Let me explain, first of all, that what Paul is doing in this section is he's making a contrast. There is a device, a way that New Testament Greek operates with two little words. One is men, M-E-N, doesn't mean men in the way we use it, and the other one is de. And they are used to make a comparison or a contrast. They always are used to point out some kind of distinction. And you've got these two little words, men and de, in this passage. In fact, you've got the couple of them twice. So it was in this part when it says, he who was of the bondwoman was according to the flesh, and he of the free man through promise, etc. Let me explain what it really means. This is my interpretation of it. It's as though you need your hands to do this. It's as though you're saying, on the one hand, this is point A. On the other hand, this is point B, or this is view A and this is view B. So you're saying on the one hand, but you can actually have only one men. This is getting complex, isn't it? Only one men, but you can have lots of de's. So you can say on the one hand, and then on the other hand, on the other hand, on the other. You can have lots of other hands. I'm going to put that complicated explanation into my own paraphrase here of Galatians chapter 4, verse 23 to 26. Listen to this. On the one hand, he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh. But on the other hand, he of the free woman through promise, which things are an allegory. For these are two covenants. On the one hand, one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. But, on the other hand, the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. Paul says this is an allegory. He says these things are allegorical. These are things which are spoken. What that really means is this. An allegory is different to a parable. We're used to parables because we have them often in the teaching of Jesus in what we call the synoptic gospels. That's the first three gospels. Now, a parable, really, we don't always use them in the way they're intended. A parable is something which has a big point at the end of it. And often, we kind of take detours into all the details, and we never actually get to the big point. For example, what is the point of the story of the lost son, the prodigal son? What's the point? Well, the point is that we should receive those who have repented and come home. You need to get to the end of the story to find what the point is. But it's very seldom that that point is actually taken up. An allegory is different. The classic allegory, of course, is John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, where every step of the way actually gives you some new information. And Paul here is using an Old Testament story, a true, authentic story, and he's using it allegorically. He's using it as, in a sense, he's using it as a list of points that he wants to kind of work his way through. My paraphrase for this would be not just saying allegorically, I would say by way of illustration. A parable has one main point and the details are incidental. An allegory is a story where every step adds more important information. So let's work our way through Paul's allegory. This is how it begins. Abraham had two sons. In Galatians 4, he says, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman." The next time almost that we hear about this second son, or this first son of Abraham, is the story of a funeral. It comes in Genesis 25. This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave at Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite. Now, when those two brothers met at Abraham's funeral, they had not met for, I reckon, 45 years. At a certain point in the life of these two, when they were separated, I almost said violently separated, they were separated because of a conflict between two mothers. Let's take that step and see how it works out. In Galatians 4 and verse 23, Paul says, "But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise." Abraham's wife, let's use the proper name, shall we? Abram, he was Abram at this point, Abram. Abram's wife, Sarai, bore no children. And at Sarai's suggestion, Abram took a slave wife, Hagar. This would have made Sarai the primary wife, and the slave wife, Hagar, would remain as Sarai's servant. It was a known practice in those days. It had a problem. If the slave bore a child, that would make her the mother of Abraham's son, which actually would raise her status. Conflict between the wives was inevitable. Sarai's intention was to acquire children through the surrogacy of Hagar's womb. So Abraham gets his son, but he will always be Hagar's son. Now, Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. In many cultures, the status of a child's mother actually determines the status of the child. A slave mother's child has the status of a slave, no matter who the father may be. And that's part of Paul's exposition of the history of Abraham and his sons. God made it clear to Hagar that in his eyes her status had not changed. She was still the servant of Sarai. When she first fled from the wrath of Sarai, it tells us this story. Now the angel of the Lord found Hagar by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid." You see, God isn't fooled by all these behind-the-scenes organizations. "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from? And where are you going?" She said, "I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her." So, the promise and the birth of Sarai. After 13 years, a son was born to Hagar named Ishmael. And after 13 years, many things happened within that 13 years. But in those 13 years, God gave Sarai a son. God had made a personal covenant with Abraham and changed his name to Abraham. God promises to establish his covenant with Abraham's son to be, Isaac. So God actually promised a son to Abraham and Sarah and actually told them what his name was. He was a son of promise. So Abraham and Hagar had a son whose name was Ishmael, but Abraham and Sarah had a son whose name would be Isaac. So Abraham's son was to be the son of promise, as distinct from Ishmael, whose birth was not the result of a fulfilled promise. Ishmael was a legitimate son of Abraham, but not a son of promise. Ishmael was outside the covenant made between God and Ishmael. This is important that we take note of this. There was no covenant bond between God and Ishmael, only a promise of future blessings. We need to distinguish between promises and covenants. Promises can be unconditional. Covenants always have conditions, either in plain sight or by implication. So, allegorically, these two women illustrate the truth of two covenants. This is why it says in our version, New King James Version, which things are symbolic. That's not a good word. These aren't symbols. These are allegories. For these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. In this allegory, the first woman, Hagar, represents Mount Sinai in Arabia. This is where God established his Sinai covenant with the people who became God's nation of Israel, his people, his saints, the people of God. That covenant, apparently, says Paul, it gives birth to bondage and slavery. You see, this is terrible. I mean, this man, Paul, remember, was a fully trained rabbi who trained under the best known rabbi of his day. He would have known the Old Testament, really, possibly most of it off by heart. He had lived with this passionate love for everything that had been, particularly the Torah, that's to say the first five books of the Bible. And yet he says here that that covenant which came into existence at Sinai, which is represented or symbolized or allegorized, is there such a word, by Sarah, actually only ever generates bondage. It only ever brings people into bondage. It gives birth to bondage. It corresponds, says Paul, to current-day Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the home of the temple and the rabbis, still continuing business as usual in the days in which Paul wrote this epistle. Paul says this to the people who are about to defect. In the area of Galatia. But now, after you've known God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements to which you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I'm afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain. Galatians 4:9-11. And then in verse 21 he said, tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? You see, to embrace the signs and symbols and celebrations of the Sinai covenant can only lead to bondage. Jerusalem, that is to say, the practice of the provisions of the Sinai covenant, is actually a slippery slope into bondage and slavery. This is really quite an amazing thing for Paul to be saying. Paul, remember, honored the law. When he wrote to the Galatians, he said that the law was glorious. He said that the gospel upholds the law. But a certain attitude to the law, where people keep rules, regulations, days, weeks, months, feasts, Passover, tabernacles, when you begin to put yourself under that regime, you begin to put yourself back under the law. And it always brings bondage. Always. The book says so. Now, in this allegory, the second woman is Sarah, who represents Jerusalem above, who is free, says Paul, and so are her children. Now, we're going to leave the question of the new covenant being the Jerusalem above until study 22b, if that's what. But this is what it goes on to say. Now, we brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. As well, we shall see that Sarah is an illustration, illustrative of the covenant that came into full effect on the day of Pentecost and the coming of the Holy Spirit. More on that, God willing, next time. But did you know that Pentecost is the anniversary of Sinai? Pentecost happened on the selfsame day of the year that they celebrated the giving of the law. So one covenant was given at Sinai, and another covenant came into full operation, full power, by the coming of the Spirit at Pentecost. More about that next week. Paul goes on, if we jump that little bit, Paul then goes on to really answer questions. Well, if that's the case, how shall we live? And he makes this point. He says, for example, here in, this is in a way, preparations for Galatians chapter 5. That's why I read on into the next chapter. This is all an unbroken flow of things. First of all, let's recognize the nature of the conflict. He says this, now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. And as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. The nature, and so the conflict, never changes. The flesh always persecutes the Spirit. The flesh always strives to dominate the Spirit. This is the preparation for Galatians chapter 5. Ishmael was born according to the flesh. That's according to natural processes, according to natural instincts, natural energies, natural powers. That's how he came. And the natural, without the guidance of the Spirit, is effectively the flesh. And it always strives against that is of the Spirit. So, okay, if we've recognized the nature of the conflict, how are we to deal with it? Well, listen to this. This is Paul. He says, expel the bondwoman and her son. Galatians 4:30. Nevertheless, what does the Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. You see, the keeping of that law can never bring you into the promise of the Spirit, the promise that was given to Abraham, which the law could never add or take away from. It always has been and always must be by grace through faith, not by do-it-yourself achievements and contributions. So, he says, expel the bondwoman. Cast her out, it says. This doesn't sound very kind, does it? There can be no neutrality on this matter. Truth is never neutral. There can be no mutual coexistence between these operating systems, back to my allegory. It's a simple either-or choice. Some things can die by neglect. You can just ignore them and they lose their power. But not legalism. And not the perversions of the gospel. They require radical surgery. Or as Paul puts it, expel the bondwoman and her son. That word cast out is used often in the Bible. We meet it first of all, of course, in the gospel, where it's used constantly, of the casting out of demon. Other spirits, other power, other dynamics which are operating. Paul says, expel them. Expel them. Spit them out. That's how it's translated. It's another point. It's also used of the attempt to prevent the shipwreck in Acts chapter 26. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. That's it. These are very vivid, dynamic pictures, aren't they? Cast out the bondwoman. Now, he doesn't say, well, you know, just build up your faith in God and slowly you'll see these other things will slowly drop away. He says, get rid of it. Cast it out. This is urgent. This needs radical surgery. Both covenants were God-given. The second covenant superseded and replaced the earlier covenant. So, recognize the nature of the conflict. It's always been there, always will be while we're on the earth. Recognize your first call to action. Expel the bondwoman and her son. Everything that has that dynamic in it, eliminate it. And thirdly, be ready for the battle. We're going to come onto the battle in chapter 5. So then, brethren, we're not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Stand fast there, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Can you see how consistent this is with the whole theme of Paul's epistle to the Galatians? They were in danger of defecting, going back to a system which actually is no longer functioning and no longer is in force. It no longer has any value in keeping of these things as keeping the law. Ah, you may say that's a terrible thing to say. Well, hang on, hold your breath, and we'll have a look at this next week. Or we'll actually, we won't, because we need the week after that, possibly. Or possibly the week after that, we'll see. I think we should stop now. Thank you for joining me and others tonight in our broken bread. And I hope you'll continue to come and visit us at BibleBased.com. And these Bible studies, incidentally, are actually operating on a podcast. So if you go to your podcast catcher and you look for Bible-based podcasts, you'll find a version of this that you listen to sequential. If you will. So, God bless you. Thank you for listening. And God willing, we'll meet again. Same time, same place, next week.